words after a year of post-stroke linguistic confusion. In this man's eyes, I wasn't simply another scientist or speech therapist in a long line of diagnosticians and do-gooders. I was a god who could bring back lost voices. Was. Now he looks at me questioningly, expectantly, so I do the only thing I can. I raise my left hand to my face, turning the counter outward. I'm sorry, he says. Before he leaves the porch to plod back to his mail truck, I close and open my eyes 3 times, as he did. We'll talk another time, he says. It's only a whisper, and then he goes. Off to my right, a door slams, its tinny aluminum double-tapping on the frame. Olivia King, hidden by a paisley umbrella, emerges from the shelter of her porch. The scarf around her head is plain pink silk, or polyester. It gives her the air of a grandmother, although Olivia is at least a decade younger than I am. She checks the skies, puts a hand out, and closes the umbrella. She does not take off the scarf before stepping from the porch and folding herself into the front seat of her car. Weekday mornings are the only times Olivia drives anymore. If her church were closer, she'd walk. In this moment, Olivia seems small, almost shrunken, a house mouse scuttling from one refuge to another, fearful of what might lie in wait along her trajectory. She's what Jackie would have called a Kool-Aid head, content with her place in the hierarchy. God, man, woman. Olivia had drunk up the poison, every last drop. My own repertoire of religious doctrine is shit, which is how I like it. But when Stephen first came home with his reading from that AP course, an innocent-sounding title, Fundamentals of Modern Christian Philosophy, blazoned on the cover, innocuous blue lettering on a white background, I leafed through the book after dinner. Pretty lame, isn't it? Stephen said on his second trip to the kitchen snack cabinet. They're mainstreaming this next year? That's what you said, right? I asked. My eyes didn't stray from the page, a chapter titled, In Search of a Natural Order in the Modern Family. The chapter, like all the others, was preceded by a biblical quote. This one, from Corinthians, informed the reader that the head of every man is Christ, the head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. Fantastic. Further along, chapter 27 began with this nugget from the book of Titus. Be teachers of good things. Teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands. The gist of the text was a call to arms of sorts, a reaching out to older generations of women. There were chapters on feminism and its insidious deconstruction of Judeo-Christian values, as well as manhood, advice for men on their roles in husbanding and parenting, guidance for children on respecting their elders. Every page screamed extreme right fundamentalism. I slammed the book shut. Tell me this isn't the only required reading. That's the book, Stephen said after he downed a mason jar of milk and refilled it halfway. So the point of this class is what? Highlighting the pitfalls of conservative Christianity? He stared at me blankly, as if I'd just asked the question in Greek. I don't know. The teacher's cool, and she makes some good points. You know, like about how hard it is on kids when both their parents work, how we've gotten to this place where people forget about simple things. I put the milk back into the fridge. How about you save some of this for your brother's breakfast? And what simple things? A slideshow played in my head. Women gardening, women canning peaches, women embroidering pillowcases by candlelight, Shakers abstaining themselves out of existence. Like, well, gardening and cooking and stuff like that, instead of running around working dumb jobs. You think I should garden and cook more? You think the work I do is less important than, I don't know, crafts? Not you, Mom. Other women. The ones who just want to get out of the house and have some kind of identity. He picked up the book and kissed me goodnight. Anyway, it's just a stupid class. I wish you'd drop it, I said. No way, Jose. I need the AP credits for college. Why? So you can major in modern Christian thought? No, so I can get into college. And that was how they did it. Sneaking in a course here, a club there. Anything to lure kids with promises of increasing their competitiveness. Such a simple thing, really. 9. The president's wife is next to him on the screen, a few steps back and to his right, her blonde hair covered by a delicate mauve scarf that matches her dress and sets off her eyes. I don't know why I turn on the television. By the time I've reheated my coffee, the rain has started beating a steady, wet rhythm again, so I don't much feel like going out. Also, it's safer here at home, by myself. No temptation to speak. She's a beauty, the First Lady. Almost a reincarnation of Jackie O, only fair and blue-eyed instead of dark. I remember her from before she married, when she decorated the pages of Vogue and Elle, almost always modeling low-cut and high-cropped swimwear or lingerie, smiling out from the magazines as if to say, "Go ahead, touch me." Now, watching her stand placidly behind her husband, I'm struck by the change. A metamorphosis, really. She appears shorter, but maybe that's because of a footwear choice. The president is not very tall, and one supposes there's an aesthetic issue at play, as if the photographers decided to even out their frames, smoothing the peaks and valleys of their subjects. Who am I kidding? She's never smiling anymore, never wearing anything that falls less than 3 inches below her knees, or that's cut lower than just at the bottom of that concavity on her throat, the one I can never remember the name of. Supra-something notch. Her sleeves are unfailingly 3/4 length, like today, and the counter on her left wrist matches her dress exactly. It looks like a piece of antique jewelry, a gift from a great-grandmother. The First Lady is supposed to be our model, a pure woman, steadfast at her husband's side in all things, at all times. Of course, she's at his side only during public events. When the cameras click off and the microphones are muted, Anna Myers, née Johansson, is promptly escorted back to her home by a trio of armed Secret Service agents. This is never filmed, but Patrick has been in attendance at more than one of the president's appearances. The trio stays with her night and day. In other times, this constant supervision of the First Lady would be accepted as routine security for her protection. The truth, however, is in Anna Myers' blue eyes. They have the vacant, lusterless quality of a woman who now sees the world in shades of gray. There was a girl in my dorm, 5 doors down on the left, who had Anna's eyes. It seemed the muscles around them never moved, never contracted and stretched to match the smile she wore when we asked if she was okay, if she felt better this morning, if she wanted to talk. I remember when we found her body, eyes open and dull, like country wells or puddles of spilled coffee. If you want to know what depression looks like, all you need to do is look into a depressed person's eyes. Strange how I can remember the dead girl's eyes, but not her name. Anna Myers lives in a prison with rose gardens and marble bathrooms and 2,000 thread count sheets on the bed. Patrick told me about her, after one of his visits as a favor to President Myers, about how the Secret Service men check Anna's bathroom twice a day, how they search her bed for objects that might have migrated unseen from the kitchen, how they hold her prescription meds and dole out pills one at a time. There are no liquor bottles in Anna's home, no locks on the doors except for those of the storage cupboard where the housekeeping supplies are. Nothing in her house is made of glass. I switch the channel. We still have cable. More than 100 choices of sports, garden shows, cooking demos, home restoration, cartoons for the children, some movies. All the movies are PG. No horror, a smattering of light comedy, those 4-hour epics about Moses and Jesus. Then there are the other channels, but they're all password protected, viewable only by the head of household and males over 18. No one needs much imagination to guess what kinds of shows are on these channels. Today, I choose golf. pure boredom involving a metal stick and a ball. When my coffee is cold and the leading player reaches the 18th hole, the doorbell rings. It's an unusual occurrence during the day. I mean, what would be the point? The only people who aren't at work are women, and what would they do? Sit in silence and watch golf? Company only draws attention to what we no longer have. I realize I'm still wearing my robe when I open the door and find Olivia, pink scarf knotted tightly around her head, not a shred or wisp of curl peeking out. She checks me over, a slow, disapproving look from my neck to my feet, and holds out a nearly empty sack of sugar and a measuring cup. I nod. If it weren't still pissing rain, I'd let her wait on the porch while I take the cup into the kitchen and pour sugar into it. Instead, I motion for her to step inside, out of the wet. Olivia follows me to the kitchen, and the stack of dirty breakfast dishes receives the same frown my bathrobe did at the front door. I'd like to slap her, or at least tell her what I think of her sanctimonious attitude. When I take the measuring cup from her hands, she grasps my wrist. Olivia's hands are cold, moist from the rain. I expect some sound, some uppity, self-righteous little, but she says nothing, only regards my counter, its ceaseless blinking of the three-digit number. She actually smiles, and the smile brings back a memory of another day, another unexpected doorbell ring, another request for a cup of sugar, a half pint of milk, an egg.
"Mind if I sit a minute?"
Olivia said 2 years ago, not waiting for a yes before she planted her ample bottom on the sofa in the den. I'd left the TV on, tuned to some talk show or another, while I waded through final exam blue books. Jackie Juarez was going head-to-toe with three women, each of them dressed like a cross between Donna Reed and an Apollo-era astronaut's wife.
"Oh, isn't she something?"
she said. It wasn't a question. "Which one?" I asked, holding out the Rubbermaid container of milk.
"The one in the red suit. The one who looks like Satan."
Jackie was a bit over the top, even for Jackie. The red stood out like a suppurating sore amid the other three women, drab and dull in their pastel twin sets. Each wore a strand of pearls, high enough on the neck to look like a collar. Jackie's chunk of pendant, an owl, dangled between her tits, pushed up by the miracle of modern underwire and padding. "I know her," I said. "Knew her. We were in grad school together."
"Grad school?" Olivia repeated. "What did she do?"
"Sociolinguistics." Olivia snorted, but didn't ask me to explain, before she turned back toward the quartet of women and the moderator. As usual, Jackie was ranting.
"You actually think women should obey their husbands? In the 21st century?"
The woman to her right, the one in the baby blue cardigan, smiled. It was the sort of smile a flustered kindergarten teacher might give to a child throwing a tantrum, a smile full of pity and understanding. "You'll grow out of it," the smile said.
"Let me tell you a few things about the 21st century, dear," Ms. Baby Blue Cardigan said. "We don't know who men are or who women are anymore. Our children are growing up confused. The culture of family has broken down. We have increases in traffic, pollution, autism rates, drug use, single parents, obesity, consumer debt, female prison populations, school shootings, erectile dysfunction. That's just to name a few."
She waved a stack of manila folders in front of Jackie as the other two 70s-era Barbie dolls, pure women, they called themselves, nodded in somber agreement. Jackie ignored the folders.
"I suppose the next thing you'll be telling us is that feminism is at fault for rape?"
"I'm glad you mentioned that, Miss Juarez," Baby Blue Cardigan said.
"Ms."
"Whatever. Do you know how many incidents of violent rape were reported in 1960? In the United States?"
"It's interesting you use the word reported," Jackie began.
17,000, give or take. We're up to 5 times that number this year."
Jackie rolled her eyes, and the other two pure women went in for the kill. They had the numbers. They had charts and surveys.
One of them introduced a collection of simple pie charts. They must have been organized in advance, I thought, while Jackie fought for airtime. On the sofa next to me, Olivia chewed her lower lip.
I had no idea, she said.
No idea about what?
These numbers.
She pointed to one of the charts, now being televised with a prepared voiceover of Baby Blue's voice. She had moved on from rape and was reciting statistics on antidepressant usage.
Jeez, 1 in 6? That's awful.
No one in the studio audience was paying attention to Jackie's claims of skewed statistics, of the correlation-causation fallacy, of the fact that of course no one was taking selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors in 1960 because they didn't exist. That was how it started. Three women with a stack of pie charts and people like Olivia. 10. It took forever to get Olivia out of the house, her and her goddamned cup of sugar. She probably didn't even need it, and only barged in to stick her nose around, see what I was up to. Olivia has become the purest of pure women, always rocking on her porch with her abridged and annotated Bible, always covering up her curls, always smiling and bowing, actually bowing to Evan when he pulls their Buick into the driveway. Bibles are still allowed, if they're the right kind. Olivia's is pink. Evan's is blue. You never see them switch, never see the blue book in Olivia's hands as she sits in the shade with her glass of sweet tea or drives off to services in their second car. It's a compact, that car, much smaller than the one Evan takes to work. By 2 o'clock, I almost wish Olivia were still here. I take 2 packages of hamburger from the freezer and set them in a lean-to on the counter to defrost. There aren't enough potatoes for all of us, let alone for 3 growing boys who seem to be hosting persistent tapeworms, so rice will have to do. Or I could make biscuits, if I can remember the proportions. Automatically, I turn to the bookshelf next to what used to be my desk in the kitchen and reach for the stained copy of Joy of Cooking as if I'm expecting it to be there. In its place, and in the place of all the other books, are a few photos of the kids, one of my parents, one of Patrick and me on our last vacation. Sam or Leo took that one, and I'm chopped in half, the right side of my face obscured by the popsicle stick frame Sonia made in school. Apparently, they still do crafts. If I move the pictures, the shelf doesn't look so abandoned, so I shuffle the frames around, stick the kitchen timer and scale in the empty spaces, and step back to admire this achievement of the day. With a little imagination, I can persuade myself I've just carved Mount fucking Rushmore. Start the ticker tape parade. Mama and Papa are now much more prominent than they were before this adventure in interior design. I'm not sure whether I want them to be. They call from Italy, or they Skype Patrick on the laptop he keeps locked in his office, the one with the keystroke logger and the camera and 1,000 other custom bells and whistles attached to it. Usually this happens on Sundays when the kids are home from school and the time difference works out so that they can say hello to the entire family. It's supposed to be joyous, but Mama ends each call in tears or hands the phone off to Papa before she breaks down. So, dinner. The kids would love biscuits, and I'm pulling on jeans and an old linen blouse, ready to risk a supermarket trip, when Patrick's car roars up the street. I know it's his. If there's one skill I've honed to a point in the past year, it's sound discrimination. Mustang, Corvette, Prius, Mini Cooper. You name the car, I know the sound. What bugs me as I look out the blinds isn't that Patrick's home early, but that 3 black SUVs are in a line behind him. I've seen those vehicles before. I've seen their insides, too. 11. Shit. 3 cars means at least 3 men. Something tells me they're not bearing precious gifts. Not today. Not after my backyard performance of last night. There will be a lecture. Maybe more than that. Mrs. McClellan, you have the right to remain silent. Okay, lousy joke. I let the blinds fall back into place, and I return to the kitchen, ready to put on my best Donna Reed face, an apron will have to do, and be the picture of domestic bliss. On the way, I hit the television's remote and changed the channel from golf to CNN. CNN isn't what it used to be, nothing is, but Patrick's job might have a better chance of survival if it looks like I've been overdosing on presidential propaganda instead of watching balls fly over manicured courses. Breaking. President announces... That's all I get to see before Patrick and his escorts, I was wrong, there are six of them, invade my space.
Gene McClellan,
says the first suit. A suntanned man who is all angles. I've seen him before, of course. Everyone has. Only he used to wear one of those black and white clerical collars instead of a necktie during his public appearances. On Sunday mornings, while Jackie and I chugged coffee to chase away a weekend hangover, he'd be on the TV, the star of his own show. Jackie turned it on as if she were one of the fold. She claimed it got her anger up.
Listen. St. Carl's about to start his shtick again, she'd say.
And there he'd be, in his minister's uniform, preaching about the fall of the American family one week, the joy of surrender to God the next. He welcomed anecdotes, real-life experiences, and the bottom few inches of the TV screen always flashed the same toll-free number. After a few years, he added a second number. In more recent years, there were Facebook links, then a Twitter account. God had sent him traffic, he said, and he would deal with it by whatever means the Lord provided. At the time, Jackie and I couldn't imagine more than a few hundred Southern Baptists from Mississippi followed Reverend Carl Corbin. It sucks to be so wrong.
Dr. Gene McClellan?
Now, this is different. I haven't been doctor anything since last spring. Also, Patrick is smiling. I nod, because there's nothing I can say. In the den, on the television, one of the talking heads says two magic words. Brain trauma. Those words alone, those three syllables, would be enough to prick up my ears, but the words that surround them hit me like a runaway train. President. Skiing accident. Brother.
Dr. McClellan, we have a problem.
It's Reverend Carl again, although he looks less like paste and more like fungus in person than when he's in front of a camera, speaking for the president.
Great. Fix it, I say. What am I, fucking Houston?
No, I don't say this. I don't say anything.
Gene,
Patrick says. Not babe, not hun, not any of those sweetisms that spouses share. He's all business now.
Gene, something's happened.
On the television, CNN is blaring. In between live footage of some snow-covered mountain, he who rules the free world flashes on and off, a picture of solemnity. Anna stands at his side, lovely in her blue and beige ensemble. It does seem that she's smiling, if only in her eyes. Reverend Carl motions to one of the others, who steps forward into my kitchen. I don't care for this intrusion. If I'm to be a silent domestic, let me at least keep some domestic sanctuary for my own.
Go ahead, Thomas,
the man in charge says. And then it happens. Thomas of the dark suit and dark mien reaches forward for my left hand. I instinctively retract, like a frightened wild dog that knows the pain of a trap, but Patrick comes toward me.
It's okay, babe. Just let them do this.
With his free hand, Thomas produces a small key. It's like an elevator key, one of those round, single-purpose gizmos that don't seem to have a reason for being except in an elevator, a device that brings to mind all the other silly little inventions. Can openers, lemon zesters, melon ballers, things that only do one thing. We have so many of them. Where do we get this shit? Bridal shower and wedding gifts, stocking stuffers, spur-of-the-moment purchases at IKEA. They're also goddamned useless, hidden in the backs of kitchen drawers, taken for granted and never taken out. This is what goes through my mind as Thomas frees me with the high-tech equivalent of a can opener.
You can speak now, Dr. McClellan.
Reverend Carl extends a hand toward my living room, like he's turned magnanimous host.
It isn't the only role reversal today. Everything they want is being broadcast on CNN as the story of the president's brother's skiing accident unfolds. As further details are reported, posterior left hemisphere, alert but uncommunicative, babbling, I know what else Reverend Carl and his crew want. They want me. If it were Anna Myers who had skied her way off-piste into a tree, I'd be out the door without a second thought, although I doubt there would be any SUV-driving men here if it were the president's wife lying in an intensive care unit. What do you want me to say? My words come out slowly, tentatively, while I move out of the kitchen, past the television, which I click off, and over to one of the wing chairs. I don't want to have to share space with any of these people.
Hot in here, Reverend Carl says, glancing toward the fridge with its built-in water and ice dispensers.
Yep, I say. One of the other men, not Thomas, coughs. I take the cue. Patrick, why don't you get our guests a glass of water, hun, since you're right there? He does, and neither of us misses the slight shake of Reverend Carl's head. I'm the wife. I should be the one serving. So, I say, sounds like Bobby Myers might have brain damage. Locus? Reverend Carl arranges himself on the love seat opposite my chair.
You're the medical man, Patrick. Show her the reports the hospital faxed over this morning.
My husband, who is on a first-name basis with the individual who single-handedly put that metal cuff on me, comes into the room with a tray of water glasses and a slim folder. He stops in front of me before passing around the drinks.
I think you'll be interested in this, Jean.
And I am. The first page is all text, and on the second line, my eyes find the reason for Reverend Carl's unexpected visit. Lesion in posterior section of STG. Superior temporal gyrus. Left hemisphere. Patient is right-handed, therefore left brain dominant.
Wernicke's area, I say to no one in particular.
As I read on, my left arm feels light, and there's a band of paler skin around my wrist, as if I'd taken off a watch before diving into a pool. One of the Secret Service men, I'm assuming that's what they are, given Carl Corbin's presence, rubs his own wrist. He wears a plain gold ring on the fourth finger of his left hand. So he knows. What camp he's in isn't clear. Like Patrick, they're all trained to follow along, rather like puppies. Reverend Carl nods.
The president is very concerned.
Sure he is. I think Mr. President relies on his older brother quite a bit, and he is going to have one hell of a time getting information either to Bobby or from him. Pieces of future conversations play themselves in my mind. There's a situation in Afghanistan, Bobby, the president will say. Bobby's response will sound something like, nice twinkles for your banana flames. His speech will be precise and fluid, each syllable articulated perfectly and without hesitation. What comes out will be absolute gibberish. Not code, not broken speech, but the ramblings of what we once called an idiot, in the clinical sense of the word. It's all I can do to keep from smiling. I have to bite the inside of my cheek hard to maintain the proper visage of seriousness, of concern, of duty. I flip through the other pages. The MRIs, or magnetic resonance images, show a substantial lesion exactly where I expect it. In Broadman Area 22. This was from a skiing accident, I say. No indication of prior damage? Of course they don't know. 34-year-old men aren't in the habit of having brain scans, not unless there's cause. Did he suffer from headaches? Reverend Carl shrugs. Is that a yes or a no, Reverend? I say.
I don't have that information.
Now I turn to Patrick, but he shakes his head.
You have to understand, Jean, we can't release the president's family's medical history.
But you want me to help?
You're the country's leading expert, Dr. McClellan.
Reverend Carl has stepped in, or leaned in across the coffee table. His face, all sharp lines, is inches from my own. There's something anime about him, but he's still handsome. He's still wearing his suit jacket, despite the heat, but under the fabric is a solid frame. I wonder if women like Olivia King are secretly in love with him. The chance to correct his tense is too good to miss. Was, I say. I don't need to tell you I haven't worked for the past year. Reverend Carl doesn't react, only sits back and staples his hands together. His long fingers forming a perfect isosceles triangle. Maybe he practices this in front of a mirror.
Well, that's why we're here today.
He pauses, like he used to do during his televised sermons, a bit of extra razzle-dazzle suspense-building effect. But I already know what he's going to say. My eyes wander from his to Patrick's to the other men in the room.
Dr. McClellan, we'd like you on our team.
12. On our team. 100 responses bubble up inside me, 99 of which would mean forced resignation, or worse, for Patrick. But anything approaching agreement or eagerness will never make its way through my brain to my mouth. Instead of excitement, I feel a gut punch of pain, as if Reverend Carl just reached out with a claw instead of words and bored into me. They might need me, but need is different from want, and I don't trust any of these men. Do I have a choice? I say. It seems safe. Reverend Carl unsteeples his hands, separating them into a saint-like gesture of prayer. I've seen him do this before, on television, when he's asking for help, for more pure women and pure men and pure families to join his fold, for money. Right now, those hands seem more like the sides of a vise ready to squeeze me until I burst. Of course, he says, his voice overgenerous and falsely kind.
I know how you must feel, how leaving your home and your children to go back into the daily grind must be...
He searches for a word as his eyes search my house. There's clutter and mess everywhere. 3 pairs of my shoes where I kicked them off last week, dust on the windowsills, an old coffee spill on the carpet next to his shoes. I've never been an ace at housekeeping. He continues.
We talked to another scientist, Dr. Kwan, in case we need a backup. You know her, I think.
Yes. Lin Kwan is the chair of my old department, or was, until they replaced her with the first man they could find. I don't need to ask why they haven't approached him for this project. If Lin had gotten her way, the guy's funding would have been severed after the first disaster of an experiment. He was that inept.
So,
Reverend Carl says. His hands are down now, and he's no longer looking at me, but at the steel cuff Thomas has been holding for the past 20 minutes.
It's your choice. You can set up a new lab, recommence your research, and move forward, or...
Or, I say, my eyes find Patrick's.
Or everything can go back to normal. I'm sure your family would like that.
He doesn't look at me while he's talking, but at Patrick, as if he's studying my husband's reaction. As if anything about our lives in the past year has been normal. Then, I get it. Carl Corbin actually believes what he preaches. At first, I'd thought he'd spun the Pure movement, that his motives for resurrecting the Victorian cult of domesticity and keeping women out of the public sphere were purely misogynistic. In a way, I wish that were true. It's less creepy than the alternative. Stephen was the first to explain it to me on a Sunday morning 2 years ago. It's sort of traditional, Mom, like in olden times. Olden times? Like what? Greece? Sumer? Babylonia? He poured himself a second bowl of cereal, mixed in 2 bananas, and topped it with half and half. By the time Sam and Leo reached 15, I'd have to buy futures in Cheerios. Well, yeah, it was there with the Greeks, the idea of public spheres and private spheres, but it goes back further. Think hunter-gatherer communities. Biologically, we're suited to different things. We, I said.
Men and women, Mom.
He stopped crunching and flexed his right arm.
See this? You could go to the gym every day for a year and you still won't have muscle like I do.
He must have seen the look of pure disbelief on my face because he reversed course.
I don't mean you're weak, just different.
Christ. I pointed to my temple.
See this, kiddo? 10 more years of school and you might have one like it, or you might not, and it has absolutely shit to do with gender.
My voice was rising.
Calm down, Mom. Don't tell me to calm down. You're getting kind of hysterical. I'm only saying that it makes biological sense to have women do some stuff and men do other stuff. Like, for instance, you're a really great teacher, but you probably wouldn't last more than an hour if you, I don't know, had a job digging ditches.
That was it. I'm a scientist, Stephen, not a kindergarten teacher. And I'm not hysterical. Well, I sort of was. I poured my second cup of coffee with shaking hands.
Stephen didn't let up. He opened his textbook from that goddamned AP class, Religious Nuttership 101 or whatever they called it, and started reading. Woman has no call to the ballot box, but she has a sphere of her own, of amazing responsibility and importance. She is the divinely appointed guardian of the home. She should more fully realize that her position as wife and mother and angel of the home is the holiest, most responsible, and queen-like assigned to mortals, and dismiss all ambition for anything higher, as there is nothing else here so high for mortals. That's Reverend John Milton Williams. See? You're queen-like.
Terrific. I needed the coffee, but didn't want Stephen to see how on edge I was, so I left it on the counter.
I think you should drop this course.
No way. I'm kinda into it. I mean, there's a crap ton to think about. Even a few of the girls say so.
I find that hard to believe, I said, not bothering to take the snideness out of my voice.
Julia King, for instance.
Julia King isn't exactly representative of the entire female population.
Poor kid, I thought, wondering what my next-door neighbors had done to brainwash their daughter.
Really, Stephen? Drop the course.
No.
15 years old, the age of defiance. I knew it well, having been there. Patrick came into the kitchen, emptied the coffee pot into a mug, and stirred in the last of the half and half.
What's going on?
He said, tousling Stephen's hair and then pecking me on the cheek.
Kinda early for a domestic argument.
Mom wants me to drop my AP religion class.
Why?
Patrick said.
I don't know. Ask her. I think she doesn't like the textbook.
The textbook is shit, I said. Patrick picked it up and flipped the pages like they were an old cartoon.
Doesn't look so bad to me.
Maybe if you tried reading it, hun.
Come on, babe. Let him take what he wants. It can't hurt anything.
I think it might have been that moment when I started hating my husband. Now I'm back in my living room, hating the 7 men seated or standing around me, waiting for me to join their ranks.
I need some details, I say. Maybe they won't notice I'm stalling.
Maybe you think I'm crazy for not leaping at the chance to go back to work. I can understand that. We could use the extra income, there is that, and I've missed my research, my books, the collaboration with Lynn and my graduate assistants. I've missed talking. Most of all, I've missed the hope. We were so fucking close.
It was Lynn's idea to abandon our fledgling work on Broca's aphasia and move on to Wernicke's. I could see her rationale. The Broca's patients stammered and stuttered with a palpable frustration, but they got their words out. For the most part, their language was intact. Only the ability to transfer it into speech had been hamstrung by a stroke, a fall down the stairs, a head injury sustained while they waded through some desert country in the uniforms of the free world. They could still comprehend, still hear their wives and daughters and fathers encouraging them on. It was the other victims, the ones with damage farther back in their brains, much like Bobby Myers, who suffered the more sinister loss. Language, for them, had become an inescapable labyrinth of non-meaning. I imagine it must feel like being lost at sea. So, yes, I want to go back. I want to forge ahead with the serum and, when I'm ready, inject that potion into Mrs. Ray's old veins. I want to hear her tell me about Quercus virginiana and Magnolia stellata and Syringa vulgaris in the way she did when she first came to my home, identifying the live oaks and the giant starry trees and the lilacs with a scent that no perfumer has been able to match. She considered them God's gifts, and I tolerated that. Whatever might be up there, he or she or it did a crackerjack job with trees and flowers. But I don't give a shit about the president or his baby brother, or, really, any man.
Well, Dr. McClellan,
Reverend Carl says. I want to tell him no. 13. Christ, it's hot in here. There must be a leak in the air conditioning compressor again. Wouldn't that be just our luck? I get up, jeans sticking to the backs of my legs, and go to the kitchen to refill my glass with water. Patrick, can you give me a hand for a sec? I call. He makes the rounds in the living room, collecting empty glasses, and joins me. While I'm pressing one glass after another into the ice dispenser, he takes hold of my left wrist. You don't want that back on, do you? I shake my head, out of habit.
You should look at it like a trade, babe. They get something, and you get something.
I should look at it like what it is, I say. Fucking blackmail. He sighs like he's been holding the entire universe in his lungs.
Then do it for the kids' sake.
The kids. Steven doesn't care. He's busy filling out college applications and writing admissions essays and boning up for exams, which are right around the corner. Also, he's been making eyes at Julia King for most of this semester. The twins, only 11, have soccer and Little League. But there's Sonia. If I'm going to trade my brain for words, I'll do it for her. The hamster wheel in my head must be making noise because Patrick stops with the water glasses and turns me toward him.
Do it for Sonia. I want more details first.
Back in the living room, I get them. Reverend Carl has morphed from politician to salesman.
Your wrist counter stays off for the duration of the project, Dr. McClellan. If you agree, of course. You'll have a state-of-the-art lab and all the funding and assistance you need. We can...
He checks the paperwork in another folder.
We can offer you a handsome stipend with a bonus if you find a viable cure within the next 90 days.
And after that? I ask, back in my chair with my jeans sticking to me.
Well...
He turns toward one of the Secret Service men. The man nods. Back to 100 words a day, I say.
Actually, Dr. McClellan, and I'm telling you this in strict confidence, understand? Actually, we'll be increasing the quota at some point in the future, once everything gets back on course.
Well, this is new. I wait to see what other confidential tidbits he's got up his sleeve.
Our hope, Reverend Carl is in full preacher mode now, is that people will settle down, find their feet in the new rhythm, and we won't need these silly little bracelets any longer.
He makes a disdainful gesture with his hand, as if he's talking about a trivial fashion accessory and not a torture device. Of course, we only feel pain if we flout the rules. I remember the day when I learned about these rules. It took only 5 minutes. There, in the bleached white government building office, the men spoke to me, at me, never with me. Patrick would be notified and given instructions. A crew would come to the house, was this evening convenient, to install cameras at the front and back doors, lock my computer away, and pack up our books, even Sonia's Baby Learns the Alphabet. The board games went into cardboard boxes, the cardboard boxes went into a closet in Patrick's office. I was to bring Sonia, barely 5 years out of my body, to the same place that afternoon so her tiny wrist could be fitted. They showed me a selection, a rainbow of colors I could choose from. Pink would be most appropriate for a little girl, they said. I pointed to silver for myself and blood red for Sonia, a trivial act of defiance. One of the men left and returned with the bracelet that would replace my Apple Watch, the one Patrick had surprised me with for Christmas last year. The metal was light, smooth, an alloy of sorts, unfamiliar to my skin. He trained the counter to my voice, set it to zero, and sent me home. Naturally, I didn't believe a word of it. Not the sketches they showed me in their book of pictures, not the warnings Patrick read aloud to me over tea at our kitchen table. When Stephen and his brothers burst in from school, full with news of soccer practice and exam results, while Sonia ignored her dolls, mesmerized by her new, shiny red wristband, I opened the dam. My words flew out, unbridled, automatic. The room filled with hundreds of them, all colors and shapes, mostly blue and sharp. The pain knocked me flat. Our bodies have a mechanism, a way to forget physical trauma. As with my non-memories of the pain of birth, I've blocked everything associated with that afternoon. Everything except the tears in Patrick's eyes, the shock, what an appropriate term, on my son's faces, and Sonia's delighted squeals as she played with the red device. There's another thing I remember. The way my little girl raised that cherry red monster to her lips, as if she were kissing it. 14. Finally, they leave. Reverend Carl slides into his Range Rover. The Secret Service men and Thomas ride in the other cars. Patrick and I are left in the living room with 8 empty glasses of water dripping rings on the coasters beneath them. Nothing has been decided yet. He's pacing the length of the room, sweat making his usually gelled down hair stick in blonde clumps around his face. Right now, he looks less like my husband and more like a caged feline. Or maybe a wild dog is the better choice. They're pack animals. They won't take off Sonia's counter, I say.
They will, eventually. Think how it would look if she turned up at school without that, don't you dare call it a bracelet. Okay, counter.
I load the tray with glasses, using only my thumb and index finger so I don't touch them more than necessary. Shaking Reverend Carl's hand made me want to scrub myself with a lie. Can't you do something? You're the one who called it a trade, so let's trade. I go to work for the bastards, they let my daughter talk.
I'll see what I can do.
Patrick, you're the president's fucking science advisor. You'd better be able to do something.
Jean.
Don't Jean me! I slam down the glass I'm holding hard, and it shatters. Patrick's over like a shot, catching the blood as it leaks from my hand. Don't touch me, I say. There's a single sliver of glass wedged in the soft pad of flesh under my thumb, and there's blood. Quite a lot of blood. As water rolls over the wound, I travel back 30 minutes, back to when Reverend Carl was holding court in my living room, educating me on the plans for the future. Something was wrong. Maybe it was his eyes, which didn't smile along with his mouth, or the pattern of his sentences. They were too well rehearsed almost, too practiced in their even cadence and intonation. Even so, the hesitance was audible. A few too many ums and ahs littered his recital of the president's intended changes, modifications, dispensations. I couldn't put my finger on exactly the moment when I realized I didn't trust him.
What if they're playing some game, Patrick? I called over the running water while he cleaned up the bits of broken glass and dumped them into the trash bin. I didn't turn to look. Those pieces of glass looked too much like our marriage. It wasn't always this way. You don't have 4 kids by accident.
He joins me at the sink, scrubs his hands as only a doctor can, all the way up to his elbows, and looks a question at me before reaching for my wrist. He's still got that gentle touch.
You want the good news or the bad news first?
Good news.
Okay. The good news is, you're not going to die.
And the bad?
I'll get my sewing kit.
Stitches. Shit.
How many? 2 or 3. Don't worry, it looks worse than it is.
When he comes back with his black bag, he pours me a short glass of bourbon.
Here, drink this. It'll take the sting away.
Then he sits me at the kitchen counter and takes the equipment out, ready to play doctor on the gash in my hand. I take a long swallow of the hard stuff, and the needle slides into my disinfected skin without much pain. Still, I won't look, only hand Patrick the pickup when he asks for it.
Damn good thing you didn't go into nursing, babe,
he says, and there's tenderness again between us. For a moment. He makes an expert knot, cuts off the excess thread, and pats my hand.
There you are, Dr. Frankenstein. Good as new.
Dr. Frankenstein wasn't the one with the zipper neck, I say. Anyway, what do you think? Are they playing a game or are they serious about what they said?
I don't know, Jean.
Jean again. He's pissed. Look, if I take this job, how do I know they won't, I don't know, use my research to promote worldwide evil?
With an anti-aphagia serum? Come on.
The blood loss and bourbon cocktail have made me lightheaded. I just don't trust these people.
All right, then.
He pours a drink for himself, then slams the bottle on the counter with enough force to hurt my ears.
Don't take the job. We'll deal with the AC when my direct deposit comes through next week. You can put your goddamn bracelet back on, and we'll all go back to exactly the way we were this morning.
Fuck you. He's mad, he's hurt, and he's frustrated. None of this justifies the next words out of his mouth, though, the ones he will never be able to take back, the ones that slice deeper than any shard of broken glass and make me bleed all over.
You know, babe, I wonder if it was better when you didn't talk.
15. Even without the metal contraption on my wrist, dinner is a quiet affair tonight. Stephen, normally garrulous in between forkfuls of food, hasn't mentioned school or Julia King or soccer. The twins seem confused and shift a little in their chairs. Sonia alternates between staring at her plate and staring at my left wrist, but she's been silent since she got home from school. Another thing? There hasn't been a single fist bump between her and Stephen. As for Patrick? He eats, takes his plate into the kitchen, and escapes to his study with a tumbler of bourbon and a few curt words about having to meet a deadline. It's impossible to tell whom he's more angry with, me or himself.
You explain it to them, Jean,
he says, before shutting the door to that book-lined sanctuary of his. Well, this is awkward. I haven't had a real conversation with my kids for more than a year. What once would have been an animated debate over whether Pokemon Go was a time waster or the cleverest innovation in gaming since Xbox is now 4 young faces staring in silent expectation, and I'm the main event. I might as well get it over with. So, Stephen, what's going on at school these days? I say.
2 exams tomorrow.
It's as if he's the one with the daily word quota. Want me to help you study?
Nah, I'm cool.
Then, as an afterthought, he adds,
thanks anyway.
Sam and Leo are slightly more eager, pummeling me with news of their new soccer coach and how they played a trick at practice this morning, each one pretending to be the other. The two of them do most of the talking. I suppose that's what they've grown used to. Only Sonia watches me with wide eyes, the kind of look that makes me feel as if I'm a new person, or have grown fur, or turned into a dragon. She's eaten none of the meatloaf on her plate, and only a few of the potatoes I'd run to the store to buy after the falling out with Patrick this afternoon.
Will I have another bad dream?
She asks. Automatically, I respond with the wrong kind of question. What makes you think that, honey? I rephrase. No, I won't let the bad dreams happen, and I'll tell you a story when I tuck you in, okay? She nods. The number on her wrist glows 40.
Scared,
she says. No reason to be. Sam and Leo exchange a nervous look, and I shake my head at them. Stephen raises one finger to his lips, his silent sign to his baby sister, something normal. Then Sonia nods again. Her eyes, Patrick's Irish hazel, are glazed over with unfallen tears. "You're still afraid?" I ask. Another nod. "Of the bad dreams?" Now she shakes her head. The thing is, Sonia doesn't know what the wrist counters do, other than glow brightly and show her numbers and pulse against her wrist one time for each word she speaks. We've been careful to keep this secret from her. Maybe it's a foolish thing, but I've never been able to figure out exactly how to describe an electric jolt of pain to a 6-year-old. It would be like telling a child about the horrors of the electric chair in order to instill some sense of right and wrong. Grisly and unnecessary. What parent would enumerate the exact workings of old Sparky to get their kid not to fib or steal? When the counters went on our wrists, there was no acclimation period, not even for children. I decided to go about it from the opposite direction. A scoop of ice cream, an extra cookie before bed, hot cocoa with as many marshmallows as would fit in the cup whenever Sonia nodded or shook her head or tugged on my sleeve instead of speaking. Positive reinforcement rather than punishment. I didn't want her to learn the hard way. Not like I had. Also, I knew something else about the counters. The pain increases with each infraction. There was no time for me on that first day to process the steady surge in charge. Patrick explained afterward as he applied cold cream to the scar on my wrist.
"First word over 100, and you'll get a slight shock, Jean. Nothing disabling, just a little jolt, a warning. You'll perceive it, but it won't actually hurt."
Terrific, I thought.
"For every 10 words after that, the charge augments by a tenth of a microcoulomb. Get to half a microcoulomb and you'll feel pain. Reach a full microcoulomb and..."
He paused and looked away.
"And the pain becomes unbearable."
He took my left hand in his own and checked the number on the counter.
"Phew, 196. Thank God you didn't keep talking. Another few words and you would have hit one microcoulomb."
Patrick and I had rather different ideas of what unbearable pain meant. He continued while I held a bag of frozen peas to the circular burn and kept my eyes trained on the closed door of Sonia's bedroom. The boys were in there with her, at Patrick's insistence, no doubt making sure she didn't speak. No one wanted a repeat performance of the electrocuted female, not when a 5-year-old was cast in the lead role.
"I think what happened is this, babe. I think you were going so fast, the device couldn't keep up."
There were tears in his eyes now.
"I'll go talk to someone about it tomorrow morning. I promise. Christ, I'm so sorry."
It took only a second's worth of imagination to see my little girl blasted from her chair, no idea why she was hurting, to turn my bowels into liquid fire. So I went about it in the Pavlovian way, focusing on the reward, as if I were training a dog, all for the greater good, I thought at the time. Now, in the middle of this odd non-conversation at our dinner table, I realize I needn't have bothered. Sonia's tears have started, falling into her plate of untouched meatloaf and potatoes like fat raindrops. "Did something bad happen at school today?" A single nod. Up once, down once. Like an exaggeration. I can fish out of her whatever secret she's holding.
"All right, baby girl. There, there."
I'm stroking her curls, trying to get some calm into her while all I want to do is scream.
"Did someone say something to you?"
The tiniest of moans escapes her lips.
"One of the other girls?"
Now her head moves right, then left under my hand. So not one of the students.
"Teacher?"
I catch her eye, just a flicker from me to Stephen. And I know. "Stephen, your turn to clean up, okay?" I say. He gives me the look. "Please," I say. I don't expect it to work, but a softness comes into my son's eyes, and he picks up the plates, careful not to stack them before they're rinsed. He makes this little bow, an insignificant thing, but I can't help seeing Reverend Carl Corbin and the way he swept out his hand this afternoon, offering me a place to sit down in my very own living room. offering, I think, and words tumble around in my head like Scrabble tiles. Officious, official, offensive, off. Off with her